Every single human being carries an element of what I'm trying to get at. We all know it. We all know that there's something fizzing beneath the surface. And my work just tries to crack the door open a little bit.
Says Mariana Simnet, who I met for another episode of Gallery Weekend Berlin, the art podcast. My name is Silke Hohmann, and I have the pleasure to talk to Mariana Simnet, who has left her resident city Berlin and is in New York right now, where she's currently staying. Very happy to welcome you to this podcast, Mariana Simnet.
Very, very, very good to be here. Thank you, Silke.
Mariana, over the last 10 years, you have set off from London and exhibited in institutions and galleries all over Europe. You've shown at the Venice Biennale, at MMK Frankfurt, in New Zealand and Australia, at the Tate in London, and again in your current home city of Berlin. Most recently, you were on show in Berlin at Hamburger Bahnhof with Winner last year, 2024. And now for Gallery Weekend Berlin, there's a new gallery exhibition of yours at Société, your second show there, which we are very eager to find out more about. Mariana, what is the biggest stereotype about Berlin? And is it true or not?
I think the biggest stereotype about Berlin is that everybody still uses fax machines. And I don't know if it's true or not, but there's been quite a few times when people have asked me for a fax, which I find wonderful, actually, that it's still this technology is being used.
I wonder if you have ever used fax.
I've never used a fax before in my life. I think we should bring back the fax.
Yeah, fax can be fun. So what is your favorite thing about Berlin or in Berlin?
I think it would have to be skinny dipping in the lakes in the summer. Skinny dipping is a polite way of saying getting butt naked.
Aha. And which lake would that be? In the city?
Oh, I mean, any of the lakes, really. Waldsee, or like, I don't know. We've been to so many places with my friends in the summer, but it's been ages and I can't wait to go again.
And what's a piece of art that you can't stop thinking about at the moment?
I think at the moment, I can't stop thinking about Doom, which I recently saw at the Armory by Anna Imhoff. And I think pretty much everyone's talking about this work, and for very good reason. It was her 3-hour epic performance that just did a 12-night run, I think, and it's just finished. And I was lucky enough to see the opening night.
Was it the first piece by Anna Imhoff that you saw?
I saw a piece at the Tate in London, and I sadly didn't see the Venice piece in real life, but I think this is just on another scale, I think. And having already done so much within the field of performance, this is almost like a culmination of so many years of work and working with the same muses and the same people and the same musicians and Eliza Douglas and all the singers. And it's just so many people and such a huge collaborative effort, and also has a lot of courage to create silence and negative space as well as the spectacle of performance. I found it really fascinating that she is daring enough to make her audience bored. That's so brave. I would be so scared to just have boredom as part of my recipe.
Yeah, I find it great that you point that out, your artist colleague, and especially because you are a performer as well. So you look from a professional perspective, of course. In your works, especially your films, you often revolve around fairy tales and stories and also myths. You take traditional material and you redo it, you retell it. Very focused, actually. We'll get to that later. But what I want to know is, did you grow up with fairy tales? What is your relationship to traditional narratives?
I was reading, I chewed through all the books in the library at school. I think when I visited back my nursery teacher, she said I was always in the book corner reading. And so storytelling has always been very important to me. It's always felt like a safe space and I've always enjoyed the more macabre, dark types of stories. Or, you know, I also, you know, anything really, from Judy Blume to Aesop's Fables to Brothers Grimm to, like, these are the Roald Dahl when I was growing up. There's so many, yeah, mischievous tales about children getting up to no good or having dysfunctional families, or, you know, also moralistic tales where there's supposed to be a lesson at the end of it. And I always found these lessons quite confusing. Like, why do we have to learn in this particular way? And because you don't know that you're being indoctrinated as a child, you're just soaking it all up. And, you know, I was happy reading the children's Bible. I'm not religious at all, but I just loved the stories. And so it didn't really matter what genre, I was just taking it all in. And I found it, and I also used to make up stories every night with my dad. So there was something about improvisation and telling tales as part of my daily bedtime. Like, we'd always make, there wouldn't be reading a story, we would make the story. Or he would just say, what do you want in the story? And then I would come up with the characters, and then we would improvise a story together about what we wanted in the story, and then the story would get told. And that evolved into lots of books and things that he also ended up writing. And so we share this father-daughter storytelling world and universe, if you like. It's come from age zero.
That sounds fantastic. I read that you grew up on the water in a boat. That sounds a bit like a fairy tale too.
Yes, that's true. I did. My father moved onto a boat when I was 6 years old, and I visited him for many years whilst I was living at home with my mother, and then moved onto the boat when I was 13 permanently, where I spent all of my teenage years. So I spent lots of time in the water, and the water as a ground or my foundation feels very resonant. It was a fairy tale. I think I do have a fairy tale existence.
In 2020, you moved from Great Britain to Berlin, and you stayed. I can still remember a certain buzz when you arrived. You were noticed.
That's so funny, because I honestly didn't feel like Germany took... I mean, I felt very welcomed, don't get me wrong, but at the same time, I had barely scratched the surface. My work had not really shown in any museums, apart from MMK in Frankfurt, but really nothing. There was nothing. And suddenly it just exploded, which was wonderful. But it was very unexpected.
Yeah, you are talking about your work, but I was talking about you as a person. It was really so much fun to see you arrive in the city as somebody who really has a idea, like, I am here. It was a certain glitter in the city all of a sudden.
That's so sweet of you. I think it's probably because I wear a lot of bright colors, and I wear a lot of, yeah, I don't know. I didn't, you're making me blush.
In your art, you tell stories in which you also appear as yourself, but often not as yourself. And most of the time in special costumes, you make music. Also, your own breathing plays a role in your work. And again and again, does your voice also, and you work with your body a lot. The first work I saw was Blood in My Milk from 2018 at MMK. And it is a partly documentary, but partly also a completely freely arranged, collaged story about milk and also about milking and the difficulties with udders. Udder is the organ in which the mammary glands are located. And you really dive pretty deep into this organ. What I find so fascinating is how safely and precisely you navigate in that very zone where something attractive and seductive can suddenly become something disgusting. And I hope I can say that. Disgusting. I think it's something that you work with.
Yeah, sure. It's not. Yeah, you can say anything. Nothing out of bounds. You can go much harder than that.
Disgusting in a way that makes you wonder if you can continue watching, really. And I find it so interesting how you balance this. And I would like to know what interests you about this point and how you would describe it, how you would define it.
Well, I think you're reminding me of the German word unheimlich, right? It's like this kind of... It's not necessarily uncanny what you're talking about, but you're talking about a sense of familiarity and safety whilst also being really revolted and turned away. And I think that is something that is deeply psychologically connected to this sense of home or belonging and, you know, feeling held by something and feeling like you're returning to something that you know. I think as much as trying to upset or disturb or subvert or push away or repel, I'm also really trying to talk about things that we fundamentally understand deep within ourselves that are quite repressed and uncomfortable parts of humanity. And it is something that gets pushed right to the bottom of our brains and hearts and souls because we don't want to talk about these things because they might disturb the smoothness of daily life. And, you know, we don't really want to go there. But at the same time, it's not possible to ignore because we all carry it. Every single human being carries an element of what I'm trying to get at. We all know it. We all know that there's something fizzing beneath the surface. And my work just tries to crack the door open a little bit.
Yeah, and what you really manage is not only to lead the viewer to that point, but you also know how to continue the story. It is not about the effect of suddenly disturbing somebody who you before somehow seduced with your art, but this is not the end. So you really go through this process and you also know where you want to go after that. So
where to take it. That's such a wonderful and such an insightful and generous point that you make. Because, and I don't think anyone's ever said that before. And it's one of the hardest things to do is to reshape stories that have been given to us by society or by other people and that you walk into, especially as a young female growing up in a world of, you know, sexual predators or whoever is around, you know, trying to navigate your place in the world as anyone of any kind of demographic. But I'm just talking from my own experience. Reshaping the story or retelling the story is it's a difficult job because sometimes you can't imagine what that might be. And often if you're trapped in thought loops or neurological cycles of behavior or, you know, obsessive compulsive disorders or whatever, like certain tendencies and patterns, it's very difficult to change that without a lot of effort and sometimes external help. But I really try to think about alternatives a lot of the time. And I'm really constantly trying to just move the compass a tiny bit, like just a little bit, just so that you can just imagine, like, what if something else happened here? And what if we didn't go down that same cliched route? And what if the princess didn't marry and get, you know, marry the prince at the end, and just try to tip the familiar narrative on its head a little bit.
In another video of yours, you filmed a race mare, a race horse, female race horse, which refused to be mated by a stallion. It could be easily interpreted as a strong feminist statement. It was also very beautiful. The animal is amazingly beautiful in its rage. But for you, you said it was also a parable on the art market, like something that equals the art market, because similar to horse racing, it is reigned by unregulated capitalism, greed, and pornography. If I am quoting you right, how are you coping with that so far in the art market?
That's a good question. I will add the caveat that this farm, by the way, was a beautiful, wonderful family farm. You know, the horses were treated absolutely with, you know, total love. And I'm making a grander comment about breeding thoroughbreds for the purpose of racehorsing. I'm not commenting on this particular farm, who were generous enough to let me nearly get kicked in the head by a stallion because I filmed it all myself. So I had to get right into the barn. Yes, there is a sense of churning it out or pornography and greed and capitalism. I think as an artist, not to rose tint my situation too much, but I'm very lucky. I really do have the best gallery, the best studio manager, the best people around to protect me from the worst sides of the art world. And we all know there's a lot of smoke and mirrors, and there are lots of dark sides to any world or any industry. And I think one of the things is the related to my Hamburger Bahnhof project, this continual striving and continual pushing yourself until you're sort of bleeding, you know? I mean, this insane amount of self-induced pressure, I think that is one of the things that is damaging potentially to artists, as well as the traps of the market, which I am not very privy to because I'm so new. It's only my second commercial gallery show, and you've named lots of other museum shows that I've done, but I'm relatively new to the swings and roundabouts of the auction systems and the secondary market. You know, it's not really my world. So I'm, so far, touch wood, I'm safe. I feel safe.
That's really good to hear. And yeah, I can imagine that it's that coping with the art market is something that is completely different from doing what an artist does. So
yeah, and it keeps changing. You know, you wake up as a kid, you want to be an artist, and the reality of actually doing this is just not what you necessarily signed up for. And I've had to change the way that I operate the studio. You know, I don't want to be a manager. I want to be an artist. I don't want to run a whole company. Like, every artist is different, but you have to figure out what your needs are and what's going to best support those needs. And for me, that's just been about relationships and close, but like really close relationships. That's the most important thing to me.
And to continue your stories, no? To just tell what you want to tell. I have seen the cows in your first major work, Blood in My Milk. I have seen a little piglet and many dogs in the great film you did for the Venice Biennale. That was called Milk of Dreams. As an expert for stories, you are, of course, aware of how animals have always been used by narrators to talk about humans. But I asked myself, to what extent are you really interested in animals as themselves? Because for myself, I must say, I am interested in animals on a formal level. I mean, I like animals, but I just interact with them visually somehow.
You don't have any pets?
No. Do you?
No, but I would. I used to keep pigeons, two pigeons, when I was living in London, and I trained them, and they used to fly back to me, and I'd give them to friends, and they'd come back because they're homing pigeons, so they know how to get home. And I had a dog via my dad's girlfriend when I was a kid. But no, I don't have a pet, and I'm sad about it. But I just travel too much, so I would never give the animal a good life. But the answer is yes. I mean, I love animals. I mean, imagine if I came on this show and said, no, I hate animals and I want to... I mean... No, it comes from a very sincere place, and it comes from a sense of not being able to necessarily fit within the world in a normal way. Like, as a kid, I wasn't the normal kid. You know, I was always slightly off doing my own thing. And animals gave me a lot of comfort as a child, and they would help me to be calm and to reduce anxiety. And yeah, I would just always feel like that was, again, somewhere I gravitate to very naturally. If there's an animal in the room and 20 humans, you'll find me with the animal.
Your upcoming gallery exhibition with Société is called Charade. Again, it's about power and masquerade and rituals, and also there are animals in it. You show paintings and drawings and a new video work with the title Leda Was a Swan. And that's very important. Leda was a swan. The story of Leda is very old. It's a tale from Greek mythology. Give us a brief summary, please, of the original.
Yes, the princess Leda was supposedly seduced by the god Zeus in the form of a swan. He metamorphosed himself into the guise of a swan in order to deceive her so that she might like this approaching bird. However, he did this only in order to rape her. And so the story talks about this rape of Leda by Zeus in the form of a swan. And it's a very violent tale, and it's been talked about and written about. There are poems about it. It's just a extremely symptomatic of patriarchy and deceit. And it also has this bestial sexual affair, which is very troubling and erotic and powerful and problematic.
And super popular. There are several depictions that have been found in Pompeii, most of them presumably in bedrooms. And Michelangelo and Leonardo da Vinci made paintings of Leda and the swan. And they are, I think they are both lost, but there are some drawings in the collection of Windsor Castle, I read. Why do you think the odd couple, Leda and the swan, is so popular? And what interests you about them in particular?
I think it's so shocking to imagine this. I mean, first of all, it's so beautiful to imagine this swan raping a woman. You know, I mean, it's horrific. It's a horrific image, but it's also stunning. And the depictions in the paintings, it's something that we have to break apart this story and actually think about what is actually going on in order to not enjoy it. But there's a great pleasure in seeing these paintings, even for me as someone who doesn't really want to endorse, you know, rape upon women like in any way or fashion. It's still alluring. It still has that kind of seductive quality. There's also a poem written by Yeats who talks about the sudden blow and the caressing of the thighs. And it's just visceral. It has a bodily impact, I think, upon the audience. And it's almost a bit cringe to take this myth on again as another artist in the contemporary field. However, of course, the piece does something different, and that's why I wanted to talk about it. But it's one of those myths that I wouldn't normally use as material in such a head-on manner, because it is one of those myths that just circulate hundreds of times throughout history.
I remember that I was immediately aware when I was a child, or maybe a teenager, maybe a child, of the frivolity of this motif, but in a different way than other erotic motifs in art. This one was different from all the, you know, peeping toms or molesters that usually populate old paintings. Tell us a bit about your interpretation of this swan.
I was responding to a 2018 discovery of a fresco in Pompeii, which was only just uncovered, and it depicts this quite, as usual, alluring image of Leda with a swan on her lap, I suppose suggesting that the swan is either about to or has just had intercourse with her. And I suddenly thought, what if Leda was the swan and she was actually not the victim, and she was just playing a game with herself, i.e. what if the swan was her arm and she was just a ventriloquist and she was making a puppet, and the swan was her hand, and she was just masturbating and just having a nice time, you know? Then the whole thing kind of just flips and mocks the big almighty god of Zeus and turns the whole thing into a bit of a sham. And I just love taking something so grand and macho and masculine and sort of just with a slight gesture, just undoing it, with a very light touch, without sort of trying to own it or tell it in another new grand light. And so then I was like, okay, well, I'd been making these mythological stories and twisting or upsetting them using machine learning. And what's great about the use of machine learning is that it doesn't regard people and subjects as singular entities. So Leda and the swan become a fusion of Leda and the, you know, Leda was a swan. Like, the complete intermingling of image and form is perfectly demonstrated through the use of AI, because it muddies fields of difference. And so it completely entangles relationships. And so I chose specifically to occupy both figures. So I dressed up as the princess and I made the swan puppet, and then we created the data sets and then essentially worked with a custom model to then generate more video material that I could edit with that would show very distorted amalgamations of bodies and flesh and feathers, and tells the story of masturbation and of becoming both characters.
Maybe we can talk about the aesthetic and the special look and your work with artificial intelligence later. I wanted to point out that it's so interesting that the psychoanalyst Carl Gustav Jung had this interpretation of the swan as being female and male together, or like this merging that you were just describing in your artistic practice that has happened before in psychoanalysis, like the, as you said, the super elegant animal, the swan, is a like a raptor on the one side, but on the other hand is also like an almost heavenly creature somehow with his wings and the white feathers. So.
Well, I guess it's just that there's like one size fits all for birds. They don't have the same genitals as humans, you know, so you don't have the same. It may have led people to create these bisexual theories around animals, that they're both female and male. What does Jung say about them? That they are both, they represent both the female and the male psychologically? Or
Jung interpreted the swan as a symbol of transcendence, a primordial unity in which male and female are unconsciously conjoined. And what you did was merging Leda and the swan. Also formally.
Yes, and figuratively and formally, yes, exactly. Turning the victim and the aggressor. Because again, just trying to disturb the binary logic between you're the evil one and I'm the good one and this is the story we're going to accept. It doesn't really work like that in real life, you know. You know, everyone contains a kernel of darkness in them. Even if they live the best, purest life in the world, they can't really escape. The pure fact of being human just involves more complexity than that. And so I think it's just, again, just opens up the door a little bit, makes more room for other narratives to emerge and to not just have these fixed archetypal characters locked in their positions.
And again, the pointe of the whole thing is not that Leda was the swan, but it is very clear from the beginning that is one person. You see a person and a swan, but you also see that they are the same person. So this is also so interesting how many levels you find in narration of just being by oneself, and there is a fight.
That was quite challenging, having a fight with myself. It was like trying to beat myself up as a swan or play. But I mean, it's really like very elemental. There's nothing too clever about it. It's just trying to use the imagination as the greatest tool, you know, to be able to imagine other stories, other worlds. And it's suggestive of a tussle or a flurry of feathers, and you know they're having a moment of interaction together, whatever that might mean.
Then on a formal level or aesthetically, you decided you nod to the aesthetics of Pompeii, like this frescoes that
yes.
have been excavated, like it's very, you can see stones and crusts and layers, and then you work with artificial intelligence, which is usually very clean aesthetic, but also, again, you manage to combine these two very contradictory elements to something that has a special aesthetic. Can you tell me what were you looking for when you decided to work with artificial intelligence for this project, and what did you find?
I'm being so much into having control over most elements of my work, it is always really difficult for me to let go and offer that control to somebody else or another machine or whatever it might be. And I found that, of course, if you use text prompts, which is what a lot of people are doing with machine learning, is, you know, trying to text prompt a situation like girl being raped by a swan. If you type that out, you're going to get some really pretty terrible results, which I have examples of because we did it as a test. You know, you get big, first of all, it has a cap on sexual language and pornographic language, which a lot of people have managed to bypass. And you have a whole realm, subcategory realm of internet porn that is produced by AI with a wealth of huge boobs and gushes of, you know, I mean, semen everywhere. It's just, it's kind of disgusting, but very cartoony and has its own horror involved in that. But that's obviously not what I wanted to do. What I wanted to do was to treat it more like a one tool along with all the other tools that I've spent so many years learning, which is filmmaking. And so I storyboarded it. I basically made it like a film, except that I just cut out, I just thought of, instead of thinking of it chronologically and linearly, I thought about it in chunks of data sets. And so we would film me falling off the chair 10 times in a row. Everything had to be repeated. So we had to shoot it digitally. At one point I wanted to use film, but it would just waste so much material because AI just likes a lot of diverse material. You have to have quantity, not necessarily quality. And so I'm just me, producer and camera person, Leander, we were just in a room together whilst I just made an absolute fool out of myself doing these different data sets in a very controlled manner, 10 to 15 in a row. And then after that, you see what happens. You work with the model to, I worked with an amazing AI artist called Arash Akbari, and together we refined the model and got it to a point where it wasn't, it essentially is trying to recreate what you've given it. So it's trying to reformulate the image that it's being given, but it does it badly because it's a machine. So you want to stop the training at a certain point so that you hit this sweet spot where it's trying, you see the effort of it's trying to form a type of reality, but it has no idea that a face is a face or a body is a body. So that's why you get these formal disturbances.
As you said, you really like to control things, and then handing it over to the machine and watching it do things that you do not control. Was that what you were looking for?
Yeah, exactly. And I suppose conceptually, I was thinking about power and I was thinking about control of the puppet. So I was thinking about a mirroring of me and the machine and the princess and the swan and the victim and the aggressor and all of these different characters that are involved in making this piece of work, ranging from the myth to the technology used to recreate the myth, and that they have a lot of echoes with each other. And I wanted that to somehow, this fight between how you make something collaboratively with these different bodies, you know, and trying to talk about this moment of interaction and this, I think that there was something really natural and organic about that relationship, and the very fabric of the film itself is made out of this. It would be different if it was just me telling a story with a swan and just making a movie about it. Somehow that lacks risk for me. So I wanted to have this element of chance and me not being the only one telling the story, but something else being allowed to chip in.
Yeah, risk is a really good word. I think you're really an artist who risks.
Yes, I mean, I try, sometimes to my detriment. I'm constantly trying to, I get bored too easily. I can't do the same thing twice. So I find myself continually pulling the rug out and learning new skills and trying to make each show a different experience.
Do you already know how it will be installed, the film, and also in combination with drawings and paintings of yours?
Yeah, so the show is going to involve a series of sculptures, paintings, and the video. And the music to the film is also composed by myself and performed also on the flute. And we are in the final stages of very, very long days and nights of learning how to become a painter, which I have a new respect for oil painters now. I have just gone into the world of oil on a large scale, and it is killing me softly, but I'm also very, very, very excited. But it's a big risk of trying to learn a whole new medium very, very quickly. But why do I want to do it? Because I'm a masochist. Why else? I don't know. I think I find that there is freedom. It's a sort of paradox, because it's the freedom that allows me to put on a new costume, essentially, throw on a new medium, learn a new skill. I fundamentally don't believe in art being medium specific. I think art is a way of life, and not, I think choosing to be an artist is a particular choice of how to live. And that is beyond what I actually make. That is, you know, bigger than that. And so I think to be forced into doing one medium my whole life almost really disrupts the logic of being an artist at all for me. And so I need to be able to have the freedom to move within this catch-all phrase of being an artist. I need to be able to not just have me understand it, but also my audience understand it, that every show could be a completely different experience to the one that you saw last time. And that takes many years to reinforce, because it takes a lot of perseverance and you have to learn a lot of new things. But the more I do it, the more grateful I am to my younger self for having paved the way for it. Because honestly, now I don't get scorn or suspicion where I used to. And now I get more like wonder and delight and maybe confusion, fine. But I think that it's the long road I'm after, not the short road. And I think over a career and a lifetime, this will start to make sense more and more and more as I get older and more mature. So why do I do it? It's a philosophical, it's an ontological, you know, why am I me kind of answer.
I think most of the people think that being an artist is being a painter. And you are an example of somebody who does something completely different. And so I would tell people about you and say, look, it's Mariana Simnes. She's a great artist, but she's not a painter. But now you're a painter.
Well, let's see what you think about them. I mean, it's really vulnerable. I think it's also just about vulnerability and hoping that that never dies, because the moment you're in control of everything to the extent that you know what you're doing, you're already doing it wrong. And I think that really staying on the edge of the precipice is my very uncomfortable way of living, that I'm, you know, continually trying to push myself to the edge of what I don't know yet and hope that that will teach me something bigger than, you know, I hope it doesn't completely floor me, or that, you know, if it's not going well, there's certain things I just know I'm not good at and I wouldn't necessarily do them. But I'm attracted to images, so why would I not try to make these, the grand, most sort of, I don't know, the biggest taboo in a way is to be a painter when you're not a painter. It's very discouraged. I'm waiting for the vultures out there. They're coming for me.
What is the most difficult thing about painting for you right now at the state you're at now?
I think that, well, first of all, like, let's just distinguish between watercolor and oil, because I've been painting watercolors on a large scale for a long time now. So it's not like I don't touch paint brushes, but oil is a very different, I think should be considered a very different medium. And it's slow. It requires patience. It's, how I put this to someone the other day, you're always working towards a goal that you can't see yet. And there's no sense of apple Z or undo. You're moving in this kind of mercurial, slippery realm of oil that is very materially sludgy. It makes you feel like you're wading through this very thick, oily swamp, and your eyes also get really like confused and foggy, and you know, you don't speak to anyone for a long time because you have to be really alone. And so you basically go a bit crazy. And I've spent hundreds of hours in the studio on my own. I think I've listened to pretty much everything that exists on the planet. Because my ears are tired. I've gone to the sort of the point of Jack in The Shining, where all work, no play makes Jack a dull boy, and he goes a bit crazy with his typewriter and doesn't speak to anyone. And you know, it's like really cliche idea of what an artist is, of this like crazy person in the corner, and that's basically what I've become. And I don't really want to take on that persona for the rest of my life. It's not a very fun character to be, I have to say. So that's the most difficult thing, the isolation, the like lack of vision. I mean, I have a vision, don't get me wrong. I have a strong vision. It's just that I can't put it into language. Like, you can't get there with the first step. You have to wait and wait and wait and do more layers and more layers and more thinners and more. Or you could just be a different type of artist and throw the paint at the canvas. And I've started to do that, actually. You'll see there's combination of very fine mark making, and then there's just this like totally like fuck it, and like everything's very visceral and thick and like painted on like icing on a cake, and really, you know, so that I've gone to so many different places with this material, and I'm only just beginning.
That sounds great. Also, it sounds conceptual, and I can't wait to see these paintings. You are showing not only the video and paintings but also sculptures. Is that new?
Yes, so I have been making, I've been thinking through sculpture, having not really come from the plastic arts world previously, because, I don't know, I have a family member who's a chronic hoarder. I was really allergic to material things. I really didn't like to make physical art before. A few years ago, let's say, most of my work involved sound, light, video, music, things that you can't necessarily touch, but you feel very deeply. And so moving into this world of wall-based and object-based work, I have to think very carefully about what that actually means for me. And one of the things I love doing is to use very, I don't know, maybe based on my upbringing of like being a former Yugoslavian or Croatian mother, making things out of yogurt pots, or making things out of nothing, basically. There's a sense of this Balkan mentality of being able to turn yourself into a princess with just a sheet over your head, which is the same as the swan, you know. very rudimentary materials suddenly take you into another realm. And so I began a series of crowns and trophies, and now as bronze sculptures that really point to this elevated, wondrous, ornate, or becoming a princess, becoming a queen, becoming a goddess. But they're made out of really shitty little plastic animals that you get in toy stores. And they're made out of the most, you know, stupid items that are then recast and turned into something much more glamorous. Then I started to make the trophies, which were coming out of this logic of being a winner. So I would make these quite strange ideas of what a trophy even means, to hold this ornament. So conceptually, there's these objects that point to power and self-importance, maybe, or yeah. And so the next body of work related to this is the reliquary, which is really hard to say. I've asked the gallery to all learn how to say the word reliquary, but it's essentially this object that comes from, you know, the medieval idea of worshipping saints and saving the relics or body parts of very important people. And they would encase them in these very ornate, beautiful objects, often taking the form of body parts. And so in the show, there are also going to be these twisted ideas of my version of what a reliquary means today. So there are, I will leave a lot to surprise, but it's taking opulence to even the next level. It's really a comment on this idea of idolatry and worshipping sculptures and objects, and wondering like what we think about that in relation to loving and worshipping art.
What's your favorite tool?
My favorite tool is probably my instrument. I don't know if that counts as a tool, but my flute is probably my favorite tool. Yeah, helps me breathe. It produces a really nice sound. It is very complicated. It's endless, endless joy playing with that tool. All the other tools change so much because it could be, you know, microphone, headphones, Apple Pencil, like paintbrush, tweezers. I don't know. I don't have one fixed tool in the studio, but I use a lot. Hands are good tools. Hands are probably my best tool.
And what's the last lesson that you learned?
I think relating to this introverted painter persona that I'm doing at the moment, that your demons can also be your friends.
What are you curious about right now?
I'm curious about the moment, the very moment before death.
Mariana Simner, thank you so much for your time and the insight and all the interesting topics that you have. And thanks for sharing them with us. I really enjoy talking to you, Mariana. Thank you so much.
I love talking to you as well. Thank you very much for having me on.
I'm Antonia Ruder, Director of Gallery Weekend Berlin, and we are thrilled to stay connected with you all year round. This podcast, hosted by art critic Silke Hohmann from Monopol Magazine and Enuma Okoro from Financial Times Weekend, offers insights into Berlin's vibrant art scene. In each episode, they'll be meeting artists, gallerists, and key players in the art world who live and work in Berlin, giving you exclusive insights into their studios and daily life in the city. If you like what you hear, don't forget to subscribe.